This is Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman, TGIF, everyone. And since it is Friday, we'll jump right into our week in review.
If one group of students are held to higher standards based on their appearance, I mean, that's not right.
And that is Swan Lee speaking to NPR this week. Lee is an organizer from Brookline, Mass., who is part of a group asking the Department of Justice to investigate Harvard amid allegations the Ivy League school discriminates against Asian Americans. This week, the Justice Department said it does have Harvard in its crosshairs over affirmative action. Attorney Corey Liu, executive director of the group Students for Fair Admissions, told WBUR race is something you're born into and shouldn't be a factor in admissions.
Should the government be sorting us, determining the destiny, our educational opportunity based on that? It's so arbitrary.
Natasha Warrico, who teaches and writes on diversity at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, cautions against an end to affirmative action.
We know what happens when you end affirmative action, where it becomes a very isolating experience for someone who is Black or Latino. It was designed as a mechanism, one small means by which we address racial inequality in American society.
And of course, we heard from Harvard in a statement. Harvard says the university complies with the legal standard as established by the Supreme Court, that is, of affirmative action, and for the first time ever in admissions. The majority of the incoming class at Harvard is non-white. Joining us now in the studio this Friday afternoon to talk about all of this and the rest of the week's news is Michael Curry, the former president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP and a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors. Hi, Michael. Nice to see you again.
Good to be here.
And with us this week is Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and a regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinions page. Thanks for coming in.
Great to be here.
So let's talk about this. We have some major institutions, I mean, including the Department of Justice and Harvard, in the middle of this conversation. Have we been here before? And is it the place for the Trump administration to be jumping in? Michael?
Yeah, I mean, we've been here before. I remember back to the Clinton years when Christopher Edley was in the administration and working on affirmative action issues. And we had a private meeting here at Harvard to talk about the attacks on affirmative action and to really have a civil rights response to those legal cases that were going on across the country. I think we're here again, and elections have consequences. So what we're now going to see is we're going to see a Trump administration try to roll back many of those gains. And that's chess, not checkers, right? It's the Supreme Court that's heavily leaning towards against affirmative action. And it's the changes that are made in the agencies below the president, particularly in the Department of Justice. We're seeing that play out. And it is very disturbing.
Michael, I did want to ask you more about the "it's very disturbing" part, because you are with the NAACP. You have seen affirmative action work in a most positive way for minorities, for African Americans. This is about Asian Americans. This is about African Americans too, though, and about any minority.
Well,
and about white people.
It's artful, right? Because part of the conversation is around people of color that have been historically denied access to these institutions, Harvard being one of the many, and that the affirmative action for many generations has been for white folks to take advantage of those seats. And I always debunk the myth that they're all super talented white folks, that the reality is many of them got those slots because of relationships and legacy and donations and so forth. There are seats that are not just because you had great test scores, and that's almost any institution you can think of.
Tom Keene, I don't mean to put you on the spot like this, but you did go to Harvard, and you are a brilliant person and a white person at that. What though do you make of this, of your alumni, of your school?
Well, I just have to say I wish I had been a legacy, but unfortunately, I didn't come out of those circumstances. So, you know, if in fact the allegation is that because you are Asian American, there are people who are actually saying that the Harvard is saying you cannot go, that's very different. But and that, I think, really starts to raise some issues. But I don't think that's what's going on here. I think what's going on here is Harvard does not only look at grades. Harvard looks at the sort of the qualities that a person has. Have you been a leader in your school? Have you participated in a variety of activities that makes the institution think you might be someone who makes a mark on society? Are you creative? Do you have some original thoughts? Do you have perhaps an unusual ethical or moral standards. You know, a kid who had good grades, not great grades, but started a soup kitchen would be of real interest there. And I think that's really what's going on here with Harvard, that people are saying, you're not admitting us because I have perfect SATs and perfect grades, but that's not enough. That's not what defines admission at Harvard.
And you know, there is this admission offices, right? And there's a lot of parents who are talking about this in addition to federal agencies and universities themselves, wondering why not my kid? But there are these admissions offices that look very closely at who these kids are. I imagine that there also is some possible quota counting in some way, but it matters who you are. You're saying,
yeah. I mean, look, if you found someone who had horrific personal circumstances growing up, deep poverty, abuse, or something like that, and yet rises to become, say, president of her class. Boy, that's someone I'd certainly like to have at Harvard, because if I were Harvard, I'd be thinking, this is a person that's going to make a mark on society.
Taking it away from Trump, I want to bring in another voice on this. It's Tomiko Brown Nagin. She is a constitutional law professor at Harvard, and she says that what is happening right now is not only in the context of Washington, but it's in the context of increased tensions on campuses.
On the one hand, you have racial minorities, immigrants who are concerned about certain dynamics on campus. On the other hand, you have conservatives who feel like their voices are being shut down in debates over things like affirmative action and immigration and sexual assault.
So it's on campus and it's in the Trump administration. What does it mean that the Trump administration has jumped in on this?
Well, I think it means ultimately, and I think as part of the disturbing part of about that is that Donald Trump, President Trump, is delivering to his base of support. These were the deliverables in his candidacy. And the reality is you have a groundswell of people, I'd say the majority of the nation, that have a raised consciousness about the history of race and racism in this country, white, black, and other, that are now more conscious, more thinking, wow, we didn't understand that police abuses were that rampant in communities of color, or the wealth gap, or health disparities. And with that growing consciousness, you're getting a backlash of people saying, wait a minute, this means less opportunity for us, less seats for us. That's that investing in your own demise argument, right, is that people don't want to give up power and access to let other people in. And it may be conscious or subconscious, but it's going to happen. It's a reality. There are more people who want access to those elite institutions and those positions and those elite law firms and medical schools. And it means less of the majority population that has historically taken advantage of that to the detriment of other communities.
Tom, is it the place for the Justice Department to be putting resources toward looking at how college campuses are colored these days?
Well, it may not be the place, but it is what they're going to be doing. And I think if you talk about it as the deliverable, if you look at Donald Trump's base, his base is perhaps a rightfully aggrieved white blue-collar white Americans who feel that they've been left behind in the economic mainstream. I think where the mistake has happened is to somehow say to that group, it's because of African Americans or Asian Americans that somehow we're pitting you off against each other. That's not the case. I mean, if one group has been left behind, by all means, try to help bring them forward. But you don't have to do that to the detriment of someone else.
Last question on this. I'm just wondering from either of you, are you surprised by any particular group's reaction to how this has played out this week? I mean, this has been ongoing for some time. But is anything surprising you from a particular culture, from a particular race or group that's organized in some way?
No, I think maybe the theme here that I think has to play out is the relationship between the African-American community and Asian community. I think we have not had the kind of conversation across races or across ethnicity around what this means. Because ultimately, as I said, chess, not checkers. Ultimately, even if you're an Asian student, go to Harvard, do you have just as much access to lead that law firm or that medical school? And the data doesn't bear that out. They're graduating from the tops of their classes, but still running into those ceilings within the professions that they go into. So the reality is the work of the NAACP and other civil rights organizations ultimately is for them, too. So we have to figure out a way to make sure that Asian students who are performing well are not disadvantaged, but that we still address the issue of other minorities and other communities of color that are being discriminated against.
I think that's a good point on Asian Americans. They're often called the quote-unquote model minority, and in a sense it means because we stereotype them and we typecast them.
Okay, let's shift gears for a moment and head over to the Registry of Motor Vehicles in Boston and Haymarket. down there in Government Center, where four clerks were charged this week, Wednesday, in connection with an alleged scheme to give false identification documents to unauthorized immigrants in exchange for cash. The U.S. Attorney's Office says the four clerks and two other people obtained the information of real Social Security cards and birth certificates from real people, and they are in Puerto Rico, and they use them to issue licenses with the stolen identities. We have some tape here from Republican State Representative Shauna O'Connell from Taunton, who said to Fox 25 News.
Law enforcement estimates that there are tens of thousands of people out there right now with stolen identities that have a Massachusetts driver's license. We need to arrest these people on the spot when they walk into the RMV.
And according to a statement from the U.S. Attorney's Office, some of the false identities and addresses were used to fraudulently register to vote in the city of Boston. Mass. Secretary of State Bill Galvin doesn't say that's the case. He told WBUR this.
It does appear that of the, I believe, 30 names that they presented us with, the 10 had registered to vote using the fraudulent information that they purchased illegally, but none of them appear to have voted.
And he went on to tell Fox 25 more.
And people steal legitimate identities, and these were legitimate citizens who had IDs that were stolen from them. And the bribery on the part of the registry employees that's alleged allowed them to access these identities. There's not much anybody can do.
I have to confess that when I first heard the story come down, I felt like a flashback to some other time of a state agency run amok. But it's not the same time, like looking at state governments that are now connected to very much into federal databases. It's so much bigger. It's a digital world. Voter registration is connected to state registrations of different kinds, supposedly easier to get to vote. What do you make of this? Again, the Trump administration is coming to some very once upon a time places that they didn't have to enter, or federal government didn't enter.
Well, I think it's important just to back up that understand that this is not new for the registry.
No, this corruption is not new for the registry.
We've been there under the past three administrations of the registry, and we've been trying to figure that out. On the federal side, I think the link between the voter fraud and integrity issues, and then trying to tie that to cases like this where such sporadic issues about, voter identity theft really feeds into this notion that we need a voter integrity commission. That, to me, is a distraction from voter suppression, which is the real issue. And I think Galvin is to be commended and others across the country who are refusing to play into that narrative.
I just want to, Michael, build on what you said. In 2012, there was a clerk at the RMV who was accused of taking money from illegal immigrants, promising them to get driver's license and fix various immigration problems. Something again happened in 2013. There were 200 fake IDs allegedly were made to people who produced Puerto Rican identifications, again, in exchange for cash.
Right.
So it's not new. My flashback may have been to that, but that aside, Tom, it's
my flashback,
it's city government,
was to
state
underage
government.
Teenage kids who also get fake IDs.
But yes, my flashback
exactly
was to New York State, where it was paper when I was under 18.
Right. Not that I knew any of those people. Michael's right. Look, if this was about identity theft, this would not be a story. This is only a story because a handful of these people allegedly registered to vote, and it feeds now into this whole national conversation pushed by the Trump administration that there were millions and millions of fraudulent voters out there voting for Hillary Clinton. It's real easy to find out if these people voted, and that's what Galvin did. He went through the voter rolls and noted that none of them had been checked off as voting. The reason they registered to vote is to give them an additional layer of protection to prove that they're really citizens. This is not part of voter fraud, and I really think it's a nothing story.
There's a nothing story, maybe, but I'm pretty amazed. This is that these folks who are working at the registry had the nerve, the idiocy, the whatever it is, the naivete to think that in this day and age when there is such a digital life, that this could just happen still.
Well, it's disturbing to me, I think, because I know that the registry under Rachel Caprilian and I believe under her administration put a lot of work into making sure this didn't happen.
Right. And I do need to say allegedly. I'm sorry. I really need to back up. And these folks are caught in something, whether or not they are truly guilty of it.
But, and there's all kind of controls put in place to make sure this didn't happen, and then audits that happen after the transactions. So I think they're going to have to go back to the drawing board at the registry and figure out how to make sure. I mean, ultimately, you can't eliminate the abuse within the system, but you can mitigate the risk of it happening. And I think they're going to have to revisit that.
You were in city politics, Tom, and at a different time, maybe,
right,
when things were not so connected inside of databases that everybody uh, that well, not everybody could access. But how hard is it to get this kind of corruption stopped? How hard is it to really check on all this?
So it seems to me that the best way to stop this corruption is to require a two-person system, that you have one check on another. It's really hard. People in conspiracies are really tough to keep together. It's possible, but if you have two people with looking or having to pass over a claim, it becomes much more difficult to say have to bribe both of them in order to to start fixing the identities here.
Ready for another story of the week?
Okay. Absolutely.
This one is television related, and it is serious, though. Another story. It's been simmering since 2014. It's now boiling over into federal court in Boston.
Hello, chefs, and welcome to Boston, the historic host city of this season of Top Chef.
Woo! I'm a hometown girl. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. I'm here to win this for Boston.
Of course, we're talking about Top Chef and the trial that got underway this week. I just want to know ahead of time, do either of you watch the show?
I do.
Okay.
I do not.
Okay,
I hesitated for a second. I do.
I'm glad you speak the truth. Okay.
It's really embarrassing, isn't it?
You do, Tom. You watch it, don't you?
No, I don't. Okay. I don't.
All joking aside, this is an important case that is involving
diners,
unions.
Drivers, and
wait.
I watch that.
Okay. Maybe we can have a whole, maybe we should throw this whole thing out and talk what you watch on TV. Teamsters involved, accused of threatening to disrupt the filming of a reality TV show in its 12th season, a well-known show, well loved by some, unless the production crew agreed to hire union labor. So producers of the TV show allege the Teamsters were blocking vehicles, slashing tires, threatening to use physical violence, yelling profanities, racial slurs. We talked about this yesterday on Radio Boston after the day in court was done. Here is a brief interaction that was released this week. I believe it was played in court yesterday. It's amazing to watch the visual of it. It's this is just the audio, of course. It came from the U.S. Attorney's Office. It's some of the Teamsters and a Top Chef producer.
Your mama would be so proud.
Yeah. At least she knows I'm not a scab like you.
What'd you say?
You heard me.
You're right.
Good.
Wow.
It's a pretty powerful video if you get a chance to watch it. Have you seen it, Michael or Tom?
I've not seen it.
The Teamsters say they are exercising their right to picket. There are racist slurs thrown in here. This could be a hate crime in some other view. Mayor Walsh in some way has his administration has a connection to this. We'll talk more about that in a second. What is your take on this in terms of Boston being a union town, a non-union town, a town that has lured film and television shows here as a plus? Michael Curry?
You know, I have a flashback right now to Mayor Menino when he was having the challenge with the firefighters, right? The imagery of folks who are labor and who are fighting for what's right and fair wages and whatever else was a part of that negotiation. But at the same time, the problem is when the passion crosses over into a meanfulness, a hatefulness, and then you start to get the crazy words and the racial hatred and all the other stuff that comes with it. I think, I'm proud of the fact that we have such a strong union town that is Boston, but disturbed whenever this boils over into the kind of wheeling and dealing and threats and embezzlement and so forth that happens every so often. Unfortunately, it is a part of our history, though. It's the untold story, and I'd love to read a book one day on how much it happens and how many folks have been complicit with it.
People want to get their work done, both the guys who drive and the gals who drive trucks and the people who are trying to make a TV show or a movie. They just want to do their job. But there are some systems that exist in the U.S., and they do fall out here in Boston in terms of who gets certain contracts. Tom, what have you seen in your history in the city of Boston as as a city councilor, former city councilor, and watching how the city has built up or how things get done?
So I think that in particular, this incident talks about a long history we've had with TV and film production and how that has really been. For a while, we were almost blacklisted by Hollywood because there was such rampant feather bedding that you come in to try to do a production, all of a sudden you're required to hire people you don't really need because it's just the Hollywood producers are seen as piggy banks. We tried to really climb our way out of that. We've put in place very healthy state tax credits to try to encourage production within the borders of the state. This, I think, is really going to hurt a long-term objective on the part of the state and of Boston to make itself seem friendly to TV and film.
And just to add, it's a little bigger than that because we go back to even the transportation contract between Keolis and NBCR. We saw a similar version of that play out. So I think it goes across whether it's the film industry, whether it's transportation, healthcare, there's probably examples across the city.
So let's also talk about Mayor Marty Walsh in the middle of all this, which he happens to be a former union leader. That's, you know, so that's great. You know, that's fine. That's about labor and who he was. He does have a close relationship between the Teamsters. I believe he was a guest on Top Chef. Is that may be the issue at hand here? Is that was there anything that we understand that's alleged is true at all about trying to get the Teamsters work on the show because of Mayor Walsh? I believe this is alleged by it is alleged in somewhere in a court testimony that I'm going to try to find while we're talking about this. But Tom, what do you know about the mayor's involvement with Teamsters and any of this?
So I don't know anything.
Of course,
the allegation here is that a top city hall official actually was willing to hold permits and withdraw the permits if, in fact, there wasn't going to be some sort of union involvement here. That is the allegation that was made in the trial this week. That same official is separately under fire for having withheld permits for Boston Calling, the music festival as well. And whether the sort of political question here is Marty Walsh is up for re-election this year. And this is one of these things that if it moved upwards and actually threatened to engulf him or other senior staff could truly have a consequence.
Do you hear buzz about this, Michael Correa?
I do. And I've for years heard buzz about elected officials in general playing that game of holding submissions and contracts and construction bids and all of those things. So I think ultimately this is about being honest with ourselves as a city, that this is how business is done. This is how things are done, and we're trying to change that culture. So we need a commitment from our elected officials that they just will not continue that going forward. And that's tough because it's a political risk, as we know, even in this film industry piece, that if you were to come out against this piece, getting them positions, then it hurts you on the election side. In right. Carmen Ortiz's case, it worked out because she was appointed, not elected.
Interesting.
Right.
Let us turn one more page today. To a little humor, a little lightness at the end of some pretty heavy news all week long, as it is in life. Before we run out of time, please, I would love to hear what story tickled your fancy this week, Tom Keene. What may have given you a chuckle even?
Well, as the folks around here at this studio know all too well, reconstruction has begun this week on the Commonwealth Avenue Bridge. Governor Baker's transportation secretary urged folks to stay away, promising a quote-unquote hellish 3 weeks, while commentators spoke darkly of Carmageddon. Okay, can we get a grip here? It's one bridge. There are many alternative ways into the city aside from the Mass Pike. Route 9, Storrow Drive, Route 2. It is possible to get here, and at the worst, it's just a traffic jam.
Tom, I got lost this morning.
You
I've
can't get lost.
I've lived here for 20 years, and I was coming from Cambridge, and I got lost.
Just use Waze.
I did.
I suspect the hyperventilating on part of the state officials was all about getting us to pay attention so we might, in fact, seek out these alternate routes. But too many of the scare-us-to-death routines, I think after a while we're going to stop paying attention at all.
All right. Michael Curry, how'd you come into here today? I just want to know before you tell us your hubbub.
I actually took the train because I had been warned that to not drive, and I usually drive.
Did you like the train?
Did
you have a shuttle bus or a train?
You know what's funny? It was the train to Kenmore and then the shuttle from Kenmore to here. So it wasn't bad, and I actually enjoyed it.
Good to know. What's your hubbub?
I think, you know, it's probably, you know, the shakeup in the State House. There's been a few stories about a lot of the changes in the Senate and in the House and new leadership and some folks who've gotten put into some key positions. I think that change is good, and I'm actually excited about some of the change, particularly Jeffrey Sanchez being the chair of House Ways and Means, a Latino. So I think that the stories around that has been encouraging for many of us who want to see more diversity throughout the State House.
Listen, this is not a humorous thing. This is a heartfelt.
So the humorous part of it, well, it's probably no humorous part of it.
In politics, there's always something. All right, so mine is, it's probably as obvious as the coffee in your cup, perhaps, the donut on your plate. Dunkin' Donuts has announced that it is going to attempt a trial run out in California, at least, of dumping the donut from its signage, its marketing. So you're going to see Dunkin'. But they have, I mean, arguably they have had, you know, Dunkin', just Dunkin' in there. But it's a donut shop. for God's sake.
I know. And not only that, but the whole Dunkin' part about putting your donut in your coffee, is so disgusting
these
days.
It is disgusting. I never understood it.
Wait, you don't dunk your coffee?
Oh, God,
no. Wait. An old-fashioned, you know, with none of the gook on it?
No.
Okay, we'll get to it. Well, maybe we'll do a donut off. Tom Kane doesn't dunk his donut in coffee. He's a former Boston City Councilor and a regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinions page. Thank you so much for coming in. Really appreciate your time.
It's a pleasure.
Michael Curry took a tea and a bus to get here today. He is president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP, former president, and a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors. Thank you so much for getting here.
Thank you.
All right, take care. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Jill Kaufman. You are listening to Radio Boston.